Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast recap of Towers of Midnight, Episode 2. I, of course, am Andrew Gallows, and with me this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. Great to be here, as always. I'm very excited to continue on with Towers of Midnight because it's actually turning out to be one of my favorite of all the books. Never thought I'd say that. And with us for this episode, we also have the indefatigable Spencer.
Hey, everyone. It is great to be here again. We're going over chapters 1 through 3 in our T of M reread. So crack open your books to that. And before we delve right into it, first off, a spoiler warning. Secondly, we will be using the Encyclopedia Watt quite a bit tonight. Not only are we basing the chapter summaries on the work that they've completed and have posted on their website, but we also use them to help us figure out who's who and what's what, why's where. So feel free to follow along on encyclopediawatt.org through the chapter summaries. It's a great way to know who that name is that you're hearing.
Here at the dawn of the last battle, when gods rage and the powers that drive the Wheel of Time roar across the landscape, mighty warriors will rise in defense of what is right and true. But the members of the Fourth Age podcast will spoil absolutely everything that happens if you are not prepared for it. This summer, be prepared for Towers of Midnight. But in all seriousness, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to be referencing absolutely everything. As Chapter 1 will tell you, we take a flashback to Eye of the World, the very first book in the series. So we'll be covering from Eye of the World all the way up through Towers of Midnight. And Towers of Midnight, we're obviously spoiling. It's a read-through of Towers of Midnight. So with that in mind, if you have not read through all of the books, and you've never glanced at the big white book, which is The World of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, you'll want to tune out until you have, because we're going to ruin it for you. And we don't like that, but it's something we have to do. So we begin with Chapter 1, Apples First. The point of view is from Mr. Almon Bunt. For those of you who do not remember, Almon Bunt gave Rand and Matt a ride to Camelin in his wagon shortly after they escaped Four Kings. He has not been seen since, but he comes back in Chapter 1. And it is wonderful because, as we'll discuss in a minute, things come full circle. And so, but as with all Wheel of Time books, we don't begin with Almon. We begin with the wind. The wind rises above the misty peaks of Imphiral and blows past 13 tall black fortresses. It passes burned ships at Takisram on the Sleeping Bay and over the Emerald Cliffs. The continent of Shanshan is in chaos. The fields of peace are burning, and the Tower of Ravens is broken. A murderer rules in Sandir, and the wind blows across the ocean, eventually reaching an apple orchard below Dragonmount. The leaves are fading to yellow, and the apples are shriveled and rotting. Almon Bunt tends this orchard. His wife, Adrian, died years ago, and his sons are managing his farm near Carysford, while he helps his sister, Alyssa, and her sons. Han, who has darker coloring like his mother and is tall for his 15 years of age, and Adim, a boy of 13 who has golden hair from his father's side. Her husband, Gregor, vanished in Nagin Bridge, and only a sulfurous-smelling gray tree was left where the man was last seen. Hands on the farm are Uso and Moore. Alman has received word that his sons back on the farm in Carysford are not doing well. His potato crop is rotting and is full of worms, and they're considering what to do, perhaps going to Camelin, but he sends them off to do other chores. Alman suddenly feels the warmth of sunlight and the apple trees around him begin to blossom. A young man walks down a path leading toward Dragon Mount. Alman asks him if he is lost, and he replies no. He finally understands the path that's before him. Alman thinks the young man looks familiar and recognizes him as one of the boys he gave a ride to a number of years ago. He comes to the conclusion that this man must be the Dragon Reborn. The young man tells him to pick the apples quickly. Alman turns, suddenly amazed to see that each tree is now loaded with ripe apples. He wonders if he's going mad, but the man tells him that it is the whole world that is going mad. The man starts to leave, and Alman asks where he's going. With a grimace, he says to do something that he has put off, and that she will not be pleased. As he leaves, Alman sees the air warp around the young man in a lateness, a kind of bright, sun-like aura. Alman feels better than he has in years, and he calls the farm hands to gather up the apples, but to gather people from the villages in order to pick the apples, because they will not last very long. He feels something tugging at him and realizes that he is being pulled after the young man, but he'll take care of the apples first.
There is a note at the end of this, too, which struck me immediately, that the warp of lightness around Rand is a stark contrast to the warp of darkness that we saw around him in the gathering storm. He's definitely undergone some massive changes after his, what we've variously entitled his epiphany on Dragonmount, which we saw in Gathering Storm.
Yeah, this chapter is our first appearance of what has been coined rather affectionately as Zen Buddy Jesus Buddha Rand. Because it struck me in the first time I read through it at how calm he was and how just everything, as I was reading, seemed to me like it was quiet. Yes, the sun was shining, the birds may have been chirping, but everything seemed quiet. And it was just that same kind of feeling that you get from any, like, fictionalized or non-fictionalized spiritual leader, where they come out and they're like, bless you, you will feel calm and good, everything is right with the world. And literally, even when he's speaking bitterly, it's like, you know, gather the apples quickly, I do not know how long I can hold him off. He's talking about the Dark One, he's talking about the major enemy in the series.
The big
and
bad.
It's a very calm thing, you know, where are you going? I'm going to do something I've been putting off. I doubt she will be pleased with me. And of course, that is a foreshadowing of one of our subsequent chapters, and we will find out later who the she is.
I think that this is actually, to change the subject a little bit, I think that this is actually one of the first scenes that we actually see take place in Shanchen, in Feral and so forth, you know, in Takasrum and Emerald Cliff. It's all in Shanchen.
We've been in Shanchen once before with Rand and Avienda, but this is the first time that we've gotten to see more than just fields of white, you know. And I think, you know, obviously the most dramatic thing about this chapter is the new Zen Buddha Rand. But I think, you know, a kind of important thing in this chapter is that it was back in the prologue of Knife of Dreams that we found out that Semirog went and murdered the entire Imperial family in Shanchen, with the exception of Tuon, who she couldn't reach right then. So, and this is the first we've actually seen of what happened in Chonchan. I mean, we got told, yeah, there's a civil war going on. This is the first we've actually seen of it. So much so, I mean, what does it say? The fields of peace are burning, the Tower of Ravens is broken, and a murderer rules in Shandar. And we know nothing about this. That's all we know.
Yeah, they don't give us any clue as to who the murderer is that is ruling.
I love how Encyclopedia Watts puts this note as, there's no indication of who this might be or if it's at all important. We don't even know if this is important right now. For heaven's sakes, think about, and I am going to spoil a scene later on in the book, when we get Tuon, you know, in her flowing gown of Obey the Empress, you know. She gets the power to travel. She gets that from Elida. And her first thing isn't, oh, well, I should go and restore the sanity to my country. Her first idea is, ooh, we should go and kill the rest of the Aes Sedai.
It's the biggest of my supply, Galgan.
Well, but the thing is we don't know what's going on in Shanshan. I'm almost willing to bet equal money that Tuon is also, excuse me, that her Imperial Majesty, the Empress, probably also doesn't know the extent to which things have deteriorated in Shanshan as well. You'll note I did not use her name. I will only do so under great duress.
Well, you're never supposed to refer to the Empress, may she live forever, by her proper name. Yeah, she's not an idiot, though, and if she knows, I mean,
she has
to know that her entire family is dead. She has to know her entire family is dead because she took over. So she knows that her entire family is dead. She would know that Shanshan would be in a state of... She should know that Shanshan would be in a state of rebellion. I could be completely wrong, but I think from what we've seen of her, especially in Knife of Dreams, I don't think she's an idiot. She's very shrewd, and she's incredibly misguided. I don't think she's an idiot.
Yeah.
So it has me wondering, and again, from later in the book, we know that Grendel had some plots in place with the Child Empress. So it has me wondering what kind of hook she had in Tuon, where not only does she have a single-minded determination to, ooh, kill all the Aes Sedai, but also just ignore Shandar.
I don't mean she's an idiot in the literal sense. I mean that she's an idiot in the sense that, you know, like Perrin was an idiot about some of the things when he was searching for Fael and everything. I mean, she's so single-mindedly focused on certain aspects of reality and just ignores all the rest of them. Just completely turns a blind eye to any other reality, you know, like, all Marathamani must be leashed. That's it. There, end of story, full stop, no negotiations, no nothing. We're just going to throw everything at it and either collar them all or kill them all, one of the two. It's like, you know, your lands are burning, your country is in chaos, everyone in your family has been killed, and you're over here killing off Aes Sedai? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, we'll get into that in that chapter, and I know I can rant at length about Tuon, and I'm sure both of you can as well. So I think we might want to leave that off until then, just so that we don't spend too much of chapter one on chapter whatever it is that one's in. But
good thinking.
No, I think it's really interesting to see, you know, just how far Shandar has fallen apart, just because, and this is really interesting. It's a really interesting dynamic. What kind of corruption had to occur there to cause this kind of state where the Imperial family is dead? Okay, I can understand the Imperial family's dead. There's no one left in the Imperial family to rule. Well, there's still an order to the blood. The next highest in the blood should rule. Well, there's four of them. Well, okay, I can understand. The murderer wipes out his other competition and they take over. That's happened in the high ranks of the blood forever. But why is the Tower of Ravens broken? Why are the Fields of Peace burning? Why are there burned ships in Takisram and Sleeping Bay? Why is this happening?
They're fighting with each other for control of the Empire.
I can't understand marching your armies on each other. I can understand the kind of backstabbing and assassination plots that the children of the Empress go through. I mean, that is the kind of atmosphere that I would expect in this situation. I wouldn't expect one of, oh my gosh, let's all freak out and kill everybody in sight. And burn things and pillage and farm. What that? Why?
It's called a civil war, my dear. They do that. We think civil war is. They turn against one another. You know, we had one here in the United States. North against the South, brother against brother, families divided, you know. It happened in countries all over the world here. I mean, I don't see why Randland countries should be any different.
The culture of Shanshan is so much different than anything that we understand. It's so much different. It's all about what rank you are. Who has what rank and, you know, the highest rank and all that. And the people with the highest rank, and there can't be very many of them, would have all the power. And those people have a very specific lifestyle and a very specific scheming, plotting mindset that we've seen in use.
There's a boatload of high blood. They're all over the place.
Well, yeah, but how many of them are high enough to attain, to even look cross-eyed at the, just a second, well, to look cross-eyed at the Silver Throne or the Crystal Throne?
Well, the thing you got to have to consider with that, though, is that a number of the people who have been raised to the blood have done so through distinct military distinguishing. General Galgen, high blood. They wouldn't have taken all of them. So you have to imagine there are a good number of generals who are like, I understand tactics. I know how to restore the peace and maintain order. And if I happen to become emperor while I'm doing it, oh no.
I guess. And, you know, I guess I didn't really think of this before now, but if they're somehow achieving glory for military feats, what is the military doing in Shanshan? Obviously, there's something there that has to be. There's some factions or rebellions or something that the military has to actually, you know, take action against for people to become heroes in their military. It can't be coincidence that we have this civil unrest in Shandar, and yet the Shanshan, according to Avienda's visions, are supposed to become so massively kind of, well, not just massively important, but powerful in that. It cannot be a coincidence that we have both these things showing up in this same book. Just because, you know, the author didn't work that way.
No, I want to say in chapter one of the aesthetics I have really enjoyed about it is that it does a very good job of showing just how badly deteriorated the condition of the entire world is, and then they contrast it by having Rand's appearance cause a writing of that twisting and that decay. It shows that there's still a lot to be done and that Rand's influence isn't permanent. So there is still danger, but it also gives us a little bit of breathing room so that it's not, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this? It's all so hopeless. You know, everything, you know, it gives us a pause right at the beginning of the book. And that pause is actually really nice because it gives us time to breathe and realize, okay, things might be bad, but it's not hopeless yet. And I really liked the way that was done.
I'm just thinking of a popular fan theory, especially that I think we heard a lot after Gathering Storm came out, you know, the idea that, you know, all the prophecy that the land is tied to the dragon and the dragon to the land and the dragon are one, or however it goes, I don't even know. The idea that the Rand was the one affecting all this, well, really the crap that we've been seeing going around Randland, you know, the persistent famine stuff, food stuff spoiling, horrible weather. And I just think, well, that's kind of been shot down now by this idea that we see Rand, kind of Zen Rand, and it doesn't fix everything, but it definitely does fix the area that he's in, which is great. Reading how Bunt goes on about how things have just gotten so absolutely horrible that this crop of apples was the last thing they were holding on to, and if because it died, they probably weren't going to last the year. The majority of them would probably shrivel up and die too, which is sad. And then Rand shows up and he saves that farm, that orchard, that town. But which, you know, when you're reading that, that's really great. Yes, the Dragon Reborn's back and he can fix things. But, you know, thinking back on it, it's like, well, How many other farms, how many other families in this book are in these same straits, are in this same situation, and they don't have the Dragon Reborn conveniently on the mountaintop over to come down and fix their crops?
Well, yeah, I mean, and when you really, you know, stop to consider, I mean, Almond thinks to himself, it's like, yeah, a lot of the time the older people just went without food. I mean, they're technically already starving, you know, in order for the younger people to get what little they can possibly have. I mean, it shows the world's not in a good way. And, yeah, it definitely sets the stage for the grander conflict that's to come.
And he certainly changed pretty dramatically from the last time that we really saw him in depth. He almost start thinking there might be some hope for the world. Hopefully that the entire world will start to heal along with him.
I would just like to point out literally how great it is to have this kind of really, really, really good chapter right at the beginning to just really contrast with the final paragraphs of the book in the epilogue. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's pretty spooky. Those of you frantically flipping pages to skip ahead, we'll wait for you to come back.
Yeah, come on back from the epilogue. No, come back.
Well,
I don't know. I think everyone who's read the epilogue of this book will forever remember it.
Oh yeah,
especially if not the last several paragraphs, then at least those last few lines, those last paragraphs right at the end of Towers of Midnight. I think those are probably going to be the most memorable paragraph for me anyway. The most memorable paragraphs in the entire Wheel of Time series.
Well, all I'm going to say about it is that listening to dark prophecies in general and how the Dark One seems to relate to his followers makes me wonder why in the world anyone would want to follow the Dark One. No.
I want power. I want power and authority.
Yeah.
The world isn't going to exist anymore. What?
Yeah, duh.
The world. It's going bye-bye. There won't be anyone to rule over.
And no immortality either.
All right. I also think we've done fairly good with Chapter 1, so...
Chapter 2 is called Questions of Leadership. We have a few. Anyway, and it starts out from Perrin's point of view. He's leading his followers through Geldian to the Geno Road. It's been well over a month since Malden, so they're closer to on track with the rest of the story, but not quite there yet. They found Maesma's remains a day out. A bubble of evil brought black snakes that injured many, including the Ashaman and Masuri. The Aes Sedai could not fully cure them, so they're still kind of sick. A few days ago, the gray cloud cover turned black. Still no sign of Basil Gil and the others that Perrin had sent north with supplies. He lets more refugees, who are a band of mercenary strongarms, join his group. He sends them to talk to Tam. They were kind of surprised that he actually had food that hadn't spoiled, and he was surprised that they're surprised. He's worried that the Shaido are still out there. And since Aram is gone, Will Alcine and Reed Salt and another one of the Two Rivers boys act as his bodyguards. Galene leads the Winged Guard, and Argonda leads the Geldian Alliance, guarding Aliandre. Berlane and Anora ride nearby. Anora's back in Berlane's good graces? Jory Conger carries the Wolfhead banner. Perrin and Tam talk and agree that Gil and the others would have taken the Geno Road towards Lugard and then gone up to Camelin. Perrin wants to send Aliandre back to Geldian, but he is worried that the Shaido scouts are still around and that the Shaido might try and attack them.
It's Gildon. It's Gildon, not Gilding.
Dahl returns from scouting with Fennel, who was sent ahead with Bazo Gil. Fennel was left behind to relay the message that the travelers reported that the area north is impassable. So Gil and the others headed east along the Geno Road to Lugard. Perrin and Fael agree that they should probably head that way as well, since, you know, that's where all their supplies are. Perrin is still reluctant about leading. No, really? And three maidens return from scouting and report that there is something important ahead. And we'll finally get around to what that is in Chapter 4. They're infamous for these horrible breaks. And then the next point of view in chapter 2, a short one from Galad, he wakes up from his beating. He's in a tent, tied down. He still has many pains. He has many sharp pains in addition to the steel healing wounds from his fight with Valda. He is in a tent bound to a stake that's been driven into the ground. He hears voices outside the tent. He composes himself so that even though he is their captor and he's been tortured by them, he still appears much like... Oh, there's been others in the book series. I just can't think of any right now. But he hears voices outside the tent. The flaps open, and to his surprise, in walk Trom, Bornhald, and Br. He gets slightly annoyed at them for having come rescue him, even though he told them not to, until the Lord's Captain Tethrol, Harnesh, and Vordarian come in with them. They executed Asanwa, and the White Cloaks are now behind Galad. I believe they had to kill several of the questioners as well. Candier enters to tend to his wounds, and they will march to Andor because Galad still holds, you know, some of his love for his half-sister. Oh, so that's chapter 2 with much editorializing, because for some reason I can't just read the text on the page anymore. There are several notes in Encyclopedia Watt for all of their chapter summaries. They have notes that go along with it to kind of supplement and to talk more about. So when you're going through the summaries, you know more than when you're just reading through the book. There's several notes here, but the only one of real note is that the travelers who told Bazael Gil that the passage north was impassable, that these travelers may have had an ulterior motive, as we know that someone was trying really hard to lead Perrin and his group right into a trap and kill them all.
Honestly, a good chunk of Perrin's, of the beginning of Perrin's segment, is rehash that we already got from the prologue. We know snakes attacked the camp. We know people were injured, including channelers, and we know that the channeling didn't work as well as it should have. A lot of what we get here is Perrin falling into the old rut about, well, I don't want to be a leader, but they're expecting me to be, but I don't want to be a leader. And, you know, honestly, I was like, good lords, please, just, I don't care what is going on. Please let him not be like this the entire book. Because if he had been like, hooray, I got my wife back, I can be a person again, but I don't want to lead, and I don't want to lose myself to the wolves for the entire book, I probably would have stabbed someone's eyes out. More than likely not my own, but somebody's.
So it's a really good thing that you hadn't finished the book by the time you actually met with Brandon, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't know I would go so far as to author aside, but you know.
he was
I guess the book didn't end up bad, so it's okay. I wondered why you were wearing that glove in all the pictures. I guess we now know it was to cover the scars from gripping the blade of the dagger too tight.
I don't think I was wearing a glove, was I?
No, I completely made that up, but most people will now be going to look.
I was wearing a hat.
He thought about it.
You did have a really amazing hat and a nice coat, too. I want both of those things. I'm going to have to steal them from you at some point in time. This does seem to be kind of a straightforward chapter. There's not much to talk about. The Galad point of view, I don't know, it seemed like it was supposed to be surprising, but for me it really wasn't. I don't know about either of you.
I was only really surprised at how quickly everything turned and went in Galad's favor. I mean, honestly, it seemed really Taverin-ish.
I was just going to say, Taverin, it can't be a Taverin.
Well, he is a Taverin's half-brother, so
Half-Taverin.
And he's a Taverin's half-brother on one side, and he's a Taverin's mistress, or Taverin's children's mother's half-brother on the other side. So either way, he's kind of close to the Taverin. Did anyone else cheer when Asanwa finally bit it? I was like, yes! Yes! This guy has been one of the most annoying protagonists since book 2, book 3 maybe, And finally, he's gone.
Oh,
thank the
Lord. I don't know. Yeah, I know, but when you compare him to, like, Messina, I mean, he's not even on the scale for annoyingness.
I don't know. I think he might be.
Well, I've got to say, I was going to mention this in the last chapter, too, but, and I said this before, but really, Karen's transformation in this book is nearly as dramatic as Rand's. I mean, he went from whiny emo boy to totally made of awesome in, like, a chapter. It's like, whoa, dude, where'd that come from? I'm like, oh, like, and actually, like, Karen again, that's great. But the serious personality changes. The only one who really hasn't changed that much is Matt. He's just, like Egwene said, he's just still Matt, just more so.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see much change in Matt until we actually get to see him and Tuan back together.
I'm not looking forward to that. No.
Well, I'm not either if Tuan continues on her current vein, but we'll get to that when we actually talk about Tuan. We're supposed to be talking about Galad and or Perrin.
I know. Well, do you think a Taverin could actually get away with slapping the Empress of the Shan-Chan upside the head a few times?
I think a Taverin could. I don't think Matt could.
He's too married.
Yes, but he's also her husband, and she's the Empress, and he's been taught his whole life not to hit women.
And she's also pretty quick herself.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
She's had a decent amount of hand-to-hand combat training as well.
Yeah, she had him pretty tied up in knots when they had their first little go-around. That's true. He had to have help from Noel to corral her, as I recall.
Yeah. And the fact that she's a channeler, even if she won't admit it.
Well, I don't think she'll use the power, though, because then she'd be Marathamani. And she's already decreed that all Marathamani must die or be leashed, one or the other.
It's going to be a sad day when Tuan has to be killed because she's just too fanatical about that.
Well, we know she dies fairly early on because it's mentioned in Avienda's visions that the old Empress was actually almost rational and reasonable, but then she died.
Yeah, almost rational and reasonable. Almost rational and reasonable? That can't be the Empress Fortuna that we saw in this, but I'm sorry. I'm not going to go there.
So, the Johanna Road. How many characters have we seen on this stupid road, too?
Oh, that's true. That's very true. Let's click the link in Encyclopedia Watts. Let's see how many times it's been brought up.
The Johanna Road is like the Broadway, you know, Broadway and Fifth or something of Randland. You know.
Yeah, Gareth follows Samwan and them on it. Perrin. Oh, yeah. I honestly think that they had to have been on it before too. I mean, I know there's the statue.
So yeah, it's Gareth, Bryn, and then all of the stuff with Perrin from Knife of Dreams and Gathering Storm.
Yeah.
And Towers of Midnight now.
So Johanna Road, it's Tarmin Gaiden Central. It's such a major roadway. That's where it's all going to take place, right? No. No.
Anything else to say about Perrin and Galad in these two points of view in this chapter?
No, Galad takes a beating and keeps on ticking.
Yeah.
That guy is pretty amazing.
Obviously, we have to kind of point out that the Perrin point of view, and because they kind of intersect the Galad point of view also, in this entire book are behind until Perrin meets up with Matt. Which gets really interesting later on into the series, later on in the book, because we get a nice chapter. I mean, we have Perrin talking with Tam, where in just the last couple chapters in Gathering Storm, we had Tam with Rand. And, you know, Tam confronting Cad Swain, which was absolutely amazing. But anyway.
Well, so, and another thing that should be mentioned about that is that at this point, we haven't quite hit the sink, but in another Perrin/Galad chapter or two, their storylines start moving in lockstep to where you'll see something happening in Perrin's camp, and then literally the next scene over will be the same exact moment what's happening in Galad's camp, and they will continue to go back and forth and ping-pong each other up until the conclusion of their particular story arc in this book.
We'll go on to Chapter 3, which is entitled The Ammerlin's Anger. We begin with Egwene's point of view, and she is in Teleronriad, where she comes to think. She avoids Gawain's dreams, because they are definitely problematical. She touches Nynaeve's dream and orders her to meet in the hall in 2 nights' time. She has left a similar order for Elaine already. She needs to let them know about the White Tower and Elaida. She then returns to her body and has a natural dream of Gawain and a simple life in the Two Rivers. Suddenly, the dream changes. She sees 13 black towers rise in the distance. The ground shakes, and one by one they fall until 6 remain, one of the fallen growing back to the tallest of them all. The scene then switches to a nest of fledgling eagles which screech for their mother. One turns into a serpent and begins swallowing the others. And then an enormous sphere made of the finest crystal was sitting on a dark hilltop. It sparkles in the light of 23 enormous stars. There are cracks in it, and it is held together by ropes. Rand walks up with a woodsman's axe and chops the ropes apart. The sphere breaks apart, falling to pieces, and Rand shakes his head. Egwene awakens in her bedchamber and records her dream. She's pretty unnerved about these dreams, actually. She's certain that the serpent is Mithaanna in the White Tower, as Varen told her. Sylviana then enters and tells her that the dragon reborn has come to see her. We then go to Swan's point of view, and she and Theron are grilling High Captain Shubane about Rand. Gareth Bryn is out with his troops, still getting them settled. Rand has arrived at the Sunset Gate, asking for the Ammerlin seat. The Aes Sedai head to the hall, but have to detour when they find another corridor changed, but shortly they do arrive. Swan thinks that Egwene made a good choice in Sylviana to replace Sheriam as a keeper of the Chronicles, but she secretly wanted the job herself. She still wants to do the job she and Moraine set out to do, which is to shepherd the Dragon Reborn to the last battle. Gareth Bryn then arrives. Gawain lurks nearby. Egwene enters and sends for her visitor. Rand enters, shielded by 26 Aes Sedai, 2 full circles, and guarded by warders. His eyes seem to look ageless. Rand speaks to Swan and Bryn, notes that they are bonded, and thanks Swan for taking an arrow that was meant for him. The Aes Sedai Tiana then runs up and hands him a letter with a red seal. Rand then enters the hall. Going back to Egwene's point, we see that Rand surprised her with his calmness. She asks what has happened, and he says that he was broken but then reforged. Cad Swain managed to set him on the right path, but by accident. Barathene has replaced Duhara. Rand speaks philosophically, and Egwene worries that he has gone mad. She tells him that she will have sisters examine him, but he refuses. Rand tells Egwene that the last time he failed was because he used only men when he tried to seal the boar. It will take both Sidene and Sidar to seal the boar this time. He says he remembers being Lucerne as though it were a dream. She sees him as earnest, not solemn like Perrin or wild like Matt. He says he will go to Shael Ghul in 1 month and break the remaining seals. He must clear the rubble, open the boar fully before it can be sealed again. He will meet them at the field of Marilor 1 day before he does this. She thinks of her dream of him letting the sphere break. He asks her leave to depart and turns to go. She then sees that his left hand is missing. After he is gone, the sitters slump in their seats. They are exhausted from this ordeal. Sylviana, Barathene, and Yukiri say they could not speak for his severe effect. Shubane reports that Bryn is following Rand to make sure that he leaves. Egwene says that they need allies to stop him from breaking the seals.
In an episode that should have been posted before this one gets posted, we did spend a lot of time talking about Egwene's dreams, and they are very interesting, but I don't know that we want to spend a lot of time on them here. It's really interesting, you know. Rand, he enters shielded by 26 Aes Sedai. Well, 26 Aes Sedai isn't possible without an Ashaman. Unless, as they have here, like Virginia pointed out, you know, there's 2 full circles. There's two circles of 13.
Yeah,
I mean, how? Yeah, the 2 circles aren't linked, but there are 2 full circles. How much overkill is this? I mean,
when you get to Egwene's point of view, her second point of view in this chapter, she thinks to herself that those 26 Aes Sedai wouldn't have done any good against Rand.
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love how paranoid these Aes Sedai are. I mean, we know for a fact that there's no way that Rand is breaking through full circle. He couldn't break through a full circle of seven until one of the idiots tied it off and left, and then he was out like a light, out like a rat. I don't know. I just love how paranoid they are that not only, oh, well, you know, 13, even though it's impossible for him to break through a shield created by 13 Link sisters, we need to have another circle of 13 sisters just in case. And even then, it's probably not going to be enough just because he is the Dragon Reborn. If he had any interest in killing you, in attacking you, he wouldn't have come with pomp, well, not pomp and circumstance. He wouldn't have come amicably. He would have come more like the frickin' Shanshan coming out of the sky with a beam of balefire.
Yeah, I mean, he just walked in there all by himself, casually, with no backup or anything, you know.
Yeah, he just walked up to one of the city guards and said, "I'm Randall Thor, the Dragon Reborn, here to see the Ammerlin."
I don't know for sure. I'd have to do some research on it, but I don't think it's impossible for a man to break through the circle of 13. I think Asmodian just told him that a circle of 13 of the weakest sisters could shield most men. I just don't know if that would apply to someone as powerful as the Dragon Reborn. It might work for most male channelers, but...
We already know that he can be held by seven. We know that from Lord of Chaos.
If they catch him unaware...
Well, no, it took the 13 to shield him initially, but after he was initially shielded, he was only held by seven at a time. While he was locked in the trunk. And it was the memories of Luz Theron that let him know that. Luz Theron knew for a fact that you cannot break through this unless one of the idiots decides to tie it off and leave, and then you just crush that like a bug and you're out of there.
The thing with that, though, and the point of that was Rand still hadn't reached the height of his power yet.
Yeah. Okay.
The men growing potential, Rand hadn't stopped his development in the One Power yet. By the point that he reaches here, I mean, I don't necessarily think it was paranoia. I honestly think that Egwene literally believed that, you know, 26 sisters in two concurrent circles would not have been enough to hold him. And honestly, if you take into account Zen Buddha-ness of the, you know, the awesomeness of light that is around him and just the sheer effect that him being in the room had on all of the sitters who were sitting there, many of whom themselves embraced the One Power, yeah, I mean, it's very possible that Rand could have just gone away whenever he wanted to. No, I mean, that might not have all just been sheer brute One Power, I'm going to break out of this, but, you know, Egwene might actually have had a decent reason to be wary, even with the amount of protection that had been placed on Rand.
I don't think that the normal rules apply to a channeler as strong as the Dragon Reborn. I just don't.
That's true. To someone who can make apples blossom on dead trees, that may not be the truth. This is interesting though. I'm looking in the Watt interview database, which is hosted by Theoryland.com, compiled by Therese, who's one of the admins at Theoryland.com. I just went into the Rand section real quick, did a search for shield, and neither of them had anything to do with this. So it would be interesting if and when we get the opportunity to talk to Brandon, if we could ask him, you know, would Rand have been able, in this scene, would Rand have been able to break through the shields? Or maybe just ask him, would Rand at his current level of power, of knowledge and power, of the One Power, in the One Power, however you want to phrase it, be able to break through a circle of 13 channelers? If he raffled that, I would laugh so hard because just the fact that he raffled it would mean so much speculation from the fan community as to, oh, that must mean that he's going to have to, he's going to get captured by the Dark Friends at some point and have to, yeah, anyway. If he were to raffle that kind of question, it would spawn many theories on, oh, so when is Rand going to have to use that in the fan community?
Yeah, and that doesn't even take into account the True Crown, but we haven't got there yet.
if he still has strength and the true power, which we don't know.
You know, I think he's gone beyond just being the most powerful channeler known to mankind in this or any other age, and moved into having nearly godlike powers. You know, can make apple blossoms bloom when all the fruit just shriveled up and fell off the tree and rotted in the space of about an hour. And he made all that go away and made them bloom, and then they turned into apples within about, 15 minutes? That's pretty amazing. And, you know, he actually does several miracles in Towers of Midnight, if you will. And they're really sort of glossed over. I don't want to spoil it, but he does one later on involving some grain. And the only thing he didn't do was turn water into wine.
And in addition to that, you know, dark friends hiding out in a room who can't even see them decide to put out their eyes and throw themselves out of third or fourth story windows because his brightness and glory exceed all description.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
whatever it was.
That comes later. Yeah, that's spoiler too, but yeah. Yeah, that was pretty creepy.
Yeah.
They weren't even facing the right direction to see him or anything. It's like, just his aura. I like the way they had the lightness warping around him, though the darkness had. That was kind of bizarre.
Yeah. So what else do we have in this chapter? We have another letter from Varen that she gave to Tiana to give to him.
Encyclopedia Watt says, we possibly learned the content of this in Chapter 32. I'm still dubious about some of the point of this meeting with Egwene. It's like he went there just to really shake her up. You know, he just casually goes and says, oh, by the way, in a month I'm going to go break the rest of the shields, the seals on the Dark One's prison. What do you think? he doesn't say, what do you think? He just says, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it might have actually been more kind of, well, politically motivated, if we want to kind of think about it in our own kind of life. But, well, a certain faction of this group, the certain faction of the White Tower, is responsible for one of the most disastrous things that had happened in the history of the White Tower, one of the most traumatic experiences in his entire life. They were responsible, not even essentially, quite literally, for his torture and false imprisonment and torture over the course of an extended period of time. And at this point, I think it's kind of he needed to show some form of olive branch. I'm not holding you responsible for what happened, basically, because it would be so easy. And I think a lot of the sisters might have, based on the knowledge of what had happened, they might have been afraid. And I think this might be why, you know, they formed the two circles around him even before Egwene told them to. But they might have been afraid of his retribution in response to that. And showing up in a very peaceful manner, speaking very cordially with the Omerlin seat, letting her in on what his plans are for the entire friggin' world, is not only showing a kindness and a courtesy to her and to the White Tower, but it's coming to them and saying, I forgive you, let's move on.
Yeah, you know, really, and when all is said and done, even before he basically ascended into Zenrand, he was basically such a nice guy that if that had been a lot of other people, it wouldn't have been the Shan-Chan attacking the White Tower. It would have been Rand because of what they did to him. You know, a lot of people wouldn't have just let that go.
I'll be perfectly honest. I think the only reason Rand didn't attack the tower is because in his mind the big bad guys were either, well, the big bad guys, obviously the Dark One and the Forsaken, but he was more kind of obsessed about the Shan-Chan than he ever was about the tower.
I think, I mean, it's also rather significant, though, that Rand shows up, he says, look, in a month I'm going to go do this thing. One day before I go and do this thing, I'm going to meet you and pretty much everybody else in the world in this spot. So he basically sets up another meeting and basically gives them one last chance to go, here's an alternative plan, please don't do what we want or what you think you have to do. You know, it shows some level of thought that he is aware that this plan that he has is going to be horribly, horribly opposed by almost everybody who hears it except Perrin. And he is at least giving them a semblance of a chance to give him an alternative. Yeah. He's not giving them much time to come up with it, but he is at least giving them that opportunity, which I think is important in some way.
Well, I agree with you. I don't think I can really add too much to that.
I'm pretty sure that this is the first instance we've ever seen of democracy in the Wheel of Time being used on kind of a global scale. The only ones not invited to the bargaining table are the Shaunchen because, hey, they want to kill everybody. But, well, kill or enslave.
Kill or leash, one or the other.
I liked how Rand, you know, walked up to Sawan and was like, so you bonded another warrior. Just kind of picked that out really nice and you know, just the amazing. And then he's like, I seem to remember you took an arrow for me once. Did I ever thank you for that?
Yeah, that was pretty cash.
just kind of randomly out there. Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to, but...
Well, and I love, because, I mean, that's just the one dry sense of humor there is like, I didn't mean to.
I mean, I'd rather let you die, but hey.
He's like, well, you have it nonetheless. Way to be high-handed there, Rand.
Yeah, pretty good.
I forget, in the earlier podcast in which we discussed Egwene's dreams, did we ever come to a consensus on what the 23 enormous stars meant?
From Linda over at 13th Depository, she says, the 23 stars could represent the full hall of sitters in Amarylin and Keeper. They could also be the 23 major human groups on the side of the light in the last battle, which are a lot, and I'm not going to list them out. Perhaps Murrindi does not participate on the side of the light. That would be interesting. Or they could represent the groups that fight or amass in Malkier, or the fields of Merilor, so that they don't include the sea folk. Egwene thinks the dream refers to Rand's plan to break the seals, and so far it looks like she's probably right.
There was another theory posted that it could also refer to the Council of 22, which was mentioned in Avienda's second Redeen experience in Chapter 49. That would be 11 Aiel wise ones, chiefs and Rand himself, which that's a weird tentative thing, but I don't see how that could be connected very well.
That's quite a bit on Chapter 3. You know, again, these first few chapters seem to be fairly straightforward, so there's not as much that we can go into to length on them. Oh, we could go into length, but you don't want to hear it. Trust me,
we've already done it in a previous podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially this one with the dream. Thank you for listening. If you want to get a hold of us, visit our website, which is dragonmount.com/podcast, and that has links to almost everywhere you want to go. For everything else, there's MasterCard. I mean, you can go to...
I knew it! I knew you were going to say that. I could feel it coming.
So could I, but I didn't know I was going to say it until I did. Anyway. No, if you want to find the rest of the rest of our amazingness, go to bit.ly/4thHforums. That's our forums. You can communicate with us there. There's all of our episodes are posted there, and you can leave comments and such after them. And I do read all of the comments. I don't respond to all of them, but I do read them all because I get them delivered to me via email. It's
wow.
Great. You
I
can do
to
it, too.
That
just
go and set I know.
That
I just... I used to, but when they changed it, I didn't set up the RSS feed for.
Yeah, I haven't set up the RSS, and I don't think that there is an RSS. I don't know. But I set up the thing to email me when there's daily of all the new posts. It's nice.
Mm. Cool.
Speaking of email, Virginia.
Yes, you can also email us. All of us at the podcast team do read all the emails, and usually one or more of us will respond. Sometimes quickly, sometimes less quickly, but usually right away. And you can email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. And you can also follow us on various of the social media sites, Twitter. We are 4th Age with no space, We have a Facebook page, also Fourth Age.
Facebook.com/TheFourthAge.
The Fourth Age, okay. Never mind.
Yeah, it's the odd duck out. Sorry, that one's my fault.
And voicemails.
Yes, you can, of course, call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
If you leave us a voicemail, there's an excellent chance that at some point in time, you will be on the podcast.
Yes. And I would like to point out, please stop sending me the letters that are sealed with the red wax. I get my hopes up, and then it's not from Varen, and I'm sad. You can send those to the other podcasters. Please stop sending them to me. They're just a downer.
Well, I just like them to stop opening the little tiny gateways and shoving stuff through. It's really kind of awkward. I mean, if you just happen to brush up against one as it's opening, you get a nice little hole in your new shirt. It's really not cool.
Oh, didn't you say that one of your dogs lost its tails that way?
No, that was something else.
Your cat?
No, I have no cats. Not now.
Oh, so you're low par. Okay.
Yeah, it was a low par. Yeah.
Anyway. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up for chapters 1 through 3. Next recording, we'll be going through 4 through something. I don't know. I don't have the schedule. 4 through what, Virginia?
Probably 6 if we can make it that far.
4 through 6.
It's a tangent.
So, until next time, may you find water and shade.
And this is Virginia, saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellis, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Serafin Tomanshima Taishite.